Maboff!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. It's hard convincing people that they could be a sucker. And when those people are also teenagers, the job seems insurmountable. No one takes more risks or is more overconfident than young people. Identity theft speaker and author James Munton has taken on that challenge, visiting high schools and showing students how to protect themselves online. This is Scammapalooza. So I'm supposedly speaking to Dallas identity theft speaker James Munton, but I have to admit you don't really sound like a stereotypical Texan. Have you stolen the real James Munton's identity?
Well, I am a Texan now. I've lived in the Dallas area for the last 9 years, and before that I was in Washington, D.C. for about 10 years. But originally I grew up in England, in London, and spent, I guess, the first 20 years of my life in the U.K. So that's why I have the accent, and I guess I haven't learned how to speak Texan properly.
Is that an accent that people pick up?
I think you can if you're 5 years old. But I think once you get to like 20 years old, you just keep the accent you've always had.
Brilliant. And your job in Texas is as an expert on scams, on identity theft, on online security, and in particular going to schools and businesses and teaching people how to keep themselves safe out there. Would that be sort of the right way to sum it up?
Well, actually, I do a few things. It's always difficult when people ask me, what do I do? I haven't quite got my little elevator pitch down, and I don't quite know how to answer the question. But I consider myself a magician. For the last 12-13 years, I've been a full-time magician here in the States, and about 6 years ago, I had my first book published on the subject of cons and scams and identity theft, and that basically kicked off a lot of speaking engagements. And then a couple of years ago, I published my second book about keeping kids safe online. And perhaps you'd be kind enough to put links in wherever this podcast appears so people can go and buy them.
Yes. So the first book is The Con, right. And the second book is CyberSense.
That's correct, yes. And I do... whenever I'm in front of an audience, because I know how to do a few tricks, I always like to do a bit of magic to kind of entertain them. When I'm a magician, I'm just doing entertainment. I'm doing magic tricks, maybe for a company event, a holiday party, something like that. But when I'm booked to do a speaking engagement, primarily I'm there to give the audience information about the topic I'm speaking on, but I use some magic in there to keep them entertained and interested. And then my real passion in all of this is I go to probably about 100 schools each year in Texas, but also in other parts of the country. I travel to California and Arizona and a few other states, and I go to elementary schools and middle schools, and I do magic shows, but they're educational magic shows. They receive some good information about a topic and have some fun with it as well. And the CyberSense book that I had published a couple of years ago basically supports the speaking engagements that I do at middle and high schools on the subjects of keeping kids safe online.
And when you go out and you do perform, you know, for the younger kids versus the adults, what do you find is the biggest difference? Not so much from sort of an entertainment standpoint, but from educating them. Like, what are the issues that are affecting young people that perhaps adults don't need to know about, and vice versa?
Well, the issues are the same for everybody. And actually, it's interesting. When I go to the middle and high schools and talk about online safety, one of the things I tell the students is, when you get home, I want you to sit down and tell mum and dad everything I've told you, because they're idiots online and doing all the same stupid stuff you are. The information is applicable for everybody, but it's especially important that younger people, teenagers especially, hear this information because they're a lot more impulsive. And so there's not so much... The message I give to them is think before you click, because just a couple of seconds pause before they share that embarrassing photo or write something mean about someone else or arrange to meet someone they've met online, that couple of seconds pause where they think about it and listen to their gut and think to themselves, is this something I really want to be doing? That's so important, because they're impulsive and they don't listen to their gut and they do this stuff. And then sadly, what they don't realize is that the stuff they do when they're 14, 15 – that follows them around forever. Nowadays, when a young person goes to apply for a job or goes to apply for college, the first thing the admissions officer does or the interviewer does is they Google them. They find out what their online presence is. And stuff, idiotic stuff they did when they were 14, 15 comes back to haunt them 4 or 5 years later when they go for the next stage of their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I like you, was lucky enough to grow up in an era where you could make all sorts of stupid mistakes and they wouldn't be sort of rubbed in your face later on.
Right.
But then I have relatives, brothers and sisters and parents, who then insist on taking those embarrassing photographs and putting them up online now. so I don't even have the benefit.
See, you can't even escape it. The technology wasn't there then, but they're still embarrassing with those photos they took all those years ago.
Exactly, that's right, yeah. I think that's right about, I mean, obviously when you're young, you tend to live in the moment and you don't think about the consequences. But you also don't think about the idea that what you're doing now, you know, stuff that's information that might be useless now is going to be extraordinarily useful in 10 years' time. So a 16-year-old doesn't really see their date of birth or their mother's maiden name as being particularly valuable information because they haven't signed up for a credit card before. But then, well, even, you know, 5 years' time, they're going to be having that information still out there, and suddenly that information has a lot more power. And I guess it's difficult to get that across to young people.
And that's what I tried to do. One of the reasons that I started, that I put together this program for the teenagers is when I was researching my first book about cons and scams, one of the statistics I was shocked to find out was that young people under the age of 20 are 51 times more likely to have their identities stolen than adults are. And the reason for this, obviously, is that if you're 13 years old and I, as an identity thief, manage to get your personal information and then abuse that and steal your identity, you don't find out about it for 4, 5, 6 years until you go and apply for your first college loan or try and get a car loan, and they bring up your credit history, and suddenly there's all this history there that you didn't even realize was on your record. So one of the things I in addition to the school shows, oftentimes I do a parents' evening on the same day. So during the day, I'll go talk to the kids at school, and then I come back after school, and we have a bunch of parents there, and I basically talk to them as well. And I say to the parents, you know, you should be getting a credit check on your kids once a year. And if there's anything on that credit history, then you may have a problem there, because they shouldn't have any accounts in their name at all.
Do parents see this sort of information as being for their kids? You know, if it's, oh, it's at the high school, my kids need to learn about online safety, but I don't because I'm an adult. I've got a friend who's a doctor and who is constantly dealing with obese children, and the parents come in and they're morbidly obese as well, and he has to sort of say, hey, if you would like your child to start eating better, maybe you should start eating better as well. And the parents get all, you know, very, very defensive. Do you find parents can sometimes kind of, they sort of, you know, they turn off, they think, oh, this isn't for me, this is for the kids?
Well, I think we're all guilty of this. We all, you know, think that it's not going to happen to us, and that somehow we're immune to this stuff. It was quite sobering. I was on my way to a school, actually, to do a parents' evening. And as I was driving, and during my presentations for the parents, one of the things I talk about is they've got to stop using their phones while they're driving their cars, because they're putting their own lives and their kids in danger. And I think this year was the first year in the US, at least, that texting and driving took over from drinking and driving as the number one cause for accidents and death in the US. So that's quite an interesting moment we've hit, where we've really got to start doing something about it. I mean, we have drink driving laws. It's only a matter of time before we've got to address this and have texting and driving. But anyways, I'm driving to the school to give this program in which I talk about driving and texting. Of course, I get to a stop sign, a traffic light. I whip out my phone, and I'm on the phone taking messages. And then and this has happened to all of us, right? We're not really looking, but we're conscious of the car next to us start moving. And so without looking up, you start moving because you think, well, the traffic's moving. When I suddenly realized the car wasn't moving, it was still a red light, and I'd started pulling out into the middle of the road while it was a red light. And I suddenly thought, oh my gosh, I'm such a hypocrite. I'm about on my way to tell people not to do this, and I just almost killed myself doing the exact same thing.
I did a show about 2 months ago for something called Streetwise, which is Street Smart, which is essentially run by the Adelaide, sort of a motoring body in Adelaide, and they get all the high school students together into the Adelaide Entertainment Centre, and they put on this full day, so they have fake car crashes crashes, they're victims of accidents, and
they,
yeah, it's this incredible day, and just full sort of spectacular event that kids just cannot help but watch and remember. And they bring me in to talk about distraction, because being a magician, I can talk about distraction.
Right.
And so I did this little 8-minute sort of presentation about distraction on the road, and then at the end of it, I went out, and I'm on my way home, and I am texting someone on my way home, and I suddenly stop and see there are two police officers, and they're coming towards me, and I panic, and like, what am I doing? And I get really not just embarrassed, but angry at myself for using my phone just after this incident, and then suddenly look around me and realize that I'm on a train. It's entirely acceptable for me to be on my phone, but I just so worked up after this day of car crashes and accidents and death and destruction, and that just the sight of two police officers getting onto a train is enough to make me panic.
Well, we are all guilty of this. We are all hypocritical when it comes to this stuff, and we all need reminding of the dangers of this stuff as well. So yeah, it's funny, but I mean, I think with the phones, the hope is that technology will also get to a point where it lessens the risk of things. I mean, we've already got cars that can read out your texts to you while you're driving along, and so we might get to the point where we don't have to be so distracted while we're driving. But until we get to that point, unfortunately, there's going to be just a lot more accidents. So yes, I think this is a problem with the parents, but also the kids as well. One of the things I try and get across to the teenagers through the use of stories and is to show them how it, none of us are immune to this. And that's one of the ways I use magic. With the audiences, it's an entertainment device. But also, everyone, when I start out in any presentation, sits there thinking, well, this is going to happen to someone else. I'm too smart for this to happen to me. So straight off the bat, I do a little magic trick and I fool everyone in the room. So I show them that, yes, we can all be tricked. We can all be fooled. And then hopefully they sit up and take some notice.
It's really interesting that magicians have, in the last maybe 5 or 10 years, suddenly become voices of authority when it comes to, the way in which people could be manipulated, the scams and cons, but also the human mind and psychology, thanks to people like Darren Brown. And high school students, 15, 20 years ago, just would not have respected a magician telling them this information, because magicians are for entertainment.
Well, maybe it's a troubling thing that people are now getting their information from magicians.
That is a good point.
As a magician, I think we are able to deliver information in a fairly unique way. And especially when it comes to certain topics, again, which people think that these things aren't going to happen to us, I think we're able to deliver the information in an entertaining way maybe gives a different a twist and a different approach to the more traditional ways of conveying this information. One of the things that that people are often surprised when they book me, especially for company corporate speaking or association events, is that I don't use PowerPoint and I don't have any slides. They always say, "Well, send us your PowerPoint slide," and I say, "Well, I don't use it." And they say, "Well, do you need a projector?" "No, I don't need any of that." And they're shocked. And I say, I can't stand the things. Anytime I sit and myself have to listen to a speaker and they've got bloody bullets on a screen behind them, I just switch off instantly. You stop listening to the person in front of you and you just read the things on the screen and that's it. You know, I do think we're uniquely placed to deliver this information in a way that kind of avoids some of those things.
I think you're right there when it comes to death by PowerPoint, and it's something that entertainers, any sort of theatre in education, gets to avoid and get around, in that you don't need to have the projector set up. And I use a data projector in my school shows, and there's always a good like 20 minutes, half an hour of fiddling around with dongles and cables and trying to get the damn thing to work. So,
well, that's the real reason I don't do it, 'cause I'm bloody lazy and I don't want to have to cart a whole bunch of stuff there, so I'd rather just jump up on stage and do my thing. I mean, that's not to say, but the other thing is, I mean, there are PowerPoint people who can use it very well and very effectively, and they do a good job using it, but it's hard to do that, I think, and the majority of people use it badly. So in response to the earlier question where you said, magicians conveying this information, I don't think as my magic background necessarily gives me any expertise on the topics that I'm sharing with the students. I mean, in my elementary school shows, I talk about bullying with the. I have a bullying show that I anti-bullying show that I do with the kids, and I'm not a trained counselor or have any expertise in bullying. But I did a crap load of research on the topic and spoke to a lot of counselors and people who do know a lot about it. And then I was able to take, you know, the important things which they said I should be sharing with the students and distill it into, you know, a number of points that I could successfully convey in a 45-minute presentation, and then I do it. So,
and what happens, I think, with a magic show or any sort of performance that inspires kids is that it gets them wanting to sort of continue being involved after the show. So rather than just sitting through a lecture where they go, oh, well, that was interesting at the end, with a magic show, there's always that sense of like, wait, what was that thing that he did with the cards? And they straight away, they're on Google, they're finding out more information, and the ideas, you know, the show sticks with them for just that right. little bit longer. Do you find that the after the show, you've got the students then sort of trying to kind of, you know, connect with you online as well?
You know, I don't, and I avoid them as much as possible online. For a couple of reasons is that, you know, they don't book my services, so there's no financial benefit for me interacting with them at all. And secondly, I'm so busy as it is, like answering emails and doing all the other stuff. If I had to then start chatting with, you know, 200 students from every show I did, it just would be a pain. I'm not good with social media. I mean, I really... I don't really have my Facebook. Basically, is friends and family, and you know, I don't really use the social media to sell my services to people. And again, going back to what I said, how I'm not, you know, I don't want to put myself in the position where if some kid has a problem with being bullied or online, or if some kid is having a problem with a predator. That's not my bag. There's other better people they should be talking to than me. So I don't really interact with my audience that much after the presentation. But again, what you'll probably find talking to me is I'm a fundamentally lazy person. So the whole thing, the reason I like to do what I do is I go somewhere, I talk for an hour to the audience, and then I'm gone, and I don't have to do it anymore. So I.
Oh yeah, I know. I'm constantly being told by teachers. Oh, you know, are you a teacher? Do you have a teaching background? You'd mm-hmm. make a great teacher. No, I'd make a terrible teacher. Like I'm fantastic for an hour, maybe an hour and a half tops. But then I just lose interest very quickly in the students and their lives.
You know, I'm a dad myself now, and I've got a 9-year-old daughter. And these kids are going through some really tough stuff. I mean, they really are having to handle a whole bunch of crap online. You know, I've heard that a lot of counselors and therapists, they are all in counseling and therapy themselves because the shit they're dealing with their clients, you know, screws them up. So they've got to then go and unburden themselves with everyone else. And as soon as you have a kid, I mean, every time I read a story now about kids, you know, something bad happening to them, it affects me now because I'm a parent so much more than it ever did before I had kids. I mean, it's almost to the point where I find it unbearable to read any kind of story of, you know, kids, you know, being abused or terrible things happening to them. So I would be just a basket case if I actually had to counsel kids in a one-to-one way and talk to them about, you know, the actual issues. So when I get up on stage, I can do so from a distance. You know, I can speak in generalities, I can talk about particular stories, but I'm not interacting directly with victims of any of this stuff. Mm. So I see my role as someone trying to prevent these bad things happening to young people. Someone else, unfortunately, gets to deal with them after they've actually happened.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience myself. I mean, obviously, you know, we both have the love of cons and scams, and and you are going to come into contact with victims. And because of the contact I've had with the victims of scams, I always feel sort of almost affronted when people say, oh, you know, do you ever want to go out and scam people in the real world? And, you know, right. like you bet you know, do really well, you know, swindling people and so on. And my reaction is no, having seen the effect that it has on people, particularly things like romance scams where someone has fallen in love with someone online and finds out, you know, it's not even a real person. It's a dozen people all working together to get their hands on their money. And having that contact with the victims of fraud and scams and obviously abuse and online bullying, without being glib, it takes the fun out of con artists and scams.
Well, and yes, and when I do my adult presentations on cons and scams, every time at the end when I'm paying up, people come over to me and tell me about things that have happened to them. And you're right, it breaks your heart when you hear some of these stories. And I've had people just weeping next to me. A good friend of mine is a Dallas cop, and there's no way I could be a cop, because if I was in the room with same room with any of these people, I'd be one of those awful cops that starts like battering someone after 5 minutes, because I just after what they'd done to their victims, I don't think I could restrain myself.
Yeah. I had one the other night. I did a grifting class that I ran, and it was called mm-hmm. sort of tongue in cheek, how to be a professional con artist. And it was just, you know, it was a chance for me to talk about right. cons and scams from the perspective of the con artist rather than from the perspective of the victim, which is what we do most of the time. And so it was right. a lot of fun, and talking about, you know, what goes on, the neurology, and how you would, you know, get in and how you'd get out and so on. And afterwards, a woman came up and said, "Oh, that was so much fun. I had a great time." Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of it really struck a chord with me, because my mother was just scammed out of $3 million. Just kind of brings you crashing straight back down to earth. You know, one minute you feel like you're in, you know, like you're in an episode of Hustle or in The Sting, right. and then suddenly it's real people and real money.
Yeah, they lose everything. One of the things I do, which I really enjoy doing, is with the police department here in Dallas. A couple of times a year, I've been doing part of their in-service training, where their beat cops who are on the beat going at the patrol. Units, they have a training week where they come in and they learn about a lot of the financial crimes. And the reason they initially brought me in is because one of the problems they were experiencing is the cops were, you know, not necessarily being that sympathetic to the victims. They were kind of, you know, when we read about these stories about cons and scams, a lot of times people's response was, "Well, what an idiot, they fell for that." And as you know very well, that these people perpetrating these crimes, very good at what they do, very manipulative. And when you read it, you know, in the newspaper the next day, it sounds like this person was an idiot, but, you know, we can all be scammed, basically.
Yeah.
And so the problem was, these police weren't taking the victims necessarily as serious as they could. And so they had me come in and basically do the same thing, fool the cops and scam them. And then so they realize, you know, just how easy it is to be scammed. And then I share a couple of stories from my book, which really strike a chord with them. There's one story in particular I share with them is a military family that was scammed. And they can relate to that. And so, yes, on the surface, the old Hollywood image of the crafty con man with the little pencil mustache, who's a charming cheat. Well, that guy doesn't really exist. I mean, as you know, these people are just evil villains.
There is a huge amount of overconfidence, particularly with young people, when it comes to technology. I think one of the things that I'm constantly butting up against is I will say something to a teenager, or it's usually a young person, about a con artist or scams, and they'll kind of roll their eyes and go, "Oh, yeah, I know that." And it's true, because they do. And they might know 90% of what there is to know about online safety or identity theft or scams, but it's the 10% that they don't know that's what's going to get them into trouble later on down the track. It only takes one, you know, pass, you know, going to one wrong website or giving your credit card details to one wrong person to lose your money. Mm-hmm. And so there's always that difficulty of kind of reminding people that the more information you know, the more likely you are to get a little bit smug and self-complacent.
Well, and also oftentimes when I think, not just with young people, when things that are bad for us, when we're told about things that are bad for us, we're basically just told, "Don't do that because it's bad for you." And this, but we're not really presented with the consequences. We don't truly get to grip with the consequences of what can happen. And like you said, that, you know, day that was put on for the kids where they showed them car crashes and all that. I mean, it might sound heavy, but, you know, these kids do need to be smacked over the head with this, because they don't get it, don't get the concept. I did a radio phone-in show a while ago, and so callers were calling in and sharing their experiences and said, "I think this was a con, did this happen to me?" One woman called in, and she said, "I was a victim of serious identity theft. They basically just really got to me and trashed everything." And she said, "It took me 12 years to basically clear my record, clear my name, get all the debt collectors off my back." She said, "I had a nervous breakdown." She said the marriage, you know, fell apart. It was just, and this woman sharing what had happened to her, a lot of times, because, you know, these kind of crimes aren't really violent crimes, you know, we think if no one pulls a gun on you, then it's somehow, it doesn't have the same impact or the same effect. But as you've spoken to people, anyone who's been a victim of identity theft, in many ways, it's almost worse because you don't trust anything. You don't trust your email. You don't trust your computer. You don't trust anytime someone phones you up. You don't trust who they are. And in the same way that after someone has their house burgled, you know, they're never going to completely feel safe in their own home again. Someone who's had their identity really trashed, they never feel completely safe in their own skin again. And it's a terrible feeling to have. And so, yeah, I think it's important to share with people, not just young people, but everyone, you know, exactly what it looks like and feels like when someone is a victim of one of these crimes.
Yeah, I noticed that you also...
This is really depressing, isn't it? We should cheer this up a little bit. Everyone's going to be like, wanted to hang themselves listening
to this. At the end of it, yeah, definitely. No, I'll put some fart noises underneath it.
Put some fun music behind while we're chatting about it.
Yeah. Depression. No, it's good. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. Okay, a slightly lighter topic. The cover of your book has, I think, one of my... A painting that I'm obsessed with, Hieronymus Bosch's The Conjurer. Which is that classic painting which magicians have seen everywhere, which is the street performer is performing, I think it's the cups and balls or a variation of the cups and balls, and a person in the crowd is so impressed, they're leaning in, they're staring in, looking absolutely gobsmacked while someone is simultaneously stealing their wallet. And it's like this, it's an amazing painting, and it's one that I think sums up what you do. Is that why you chose it from the front cover? It's that mix of magic and con artistry that's... Is that sort of why it ended up on the front cover?
I've always loved that, and I've always loved that that painting. And it's a painting. Actually, that the more you look at it, you see more stuff going on. I mean, there's the little kid as well who's involved somehow. He's leaning in. There's a guy in the back who's got his arm around a lady, and he's kind of pointing to a necklace. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on in that painting that I absolutely love. When the publisher actually asked for my suggestions for the cover, and I just said, look, I don't know if it's possible, but I've always loved this painting. And it turned out it was I guess in the public domain. The print was in the public domain, so the publisher loved it because they didn't have to pay anything for it. And so that went on the front cover. And yes, I think it illustrates really well both what goes on when a con or scam is happening, but as you said, also represents what we do as performers and people who share this information with the public.
Yeah, Charles Ponzi, he said, even if they never got anything for it, it was cheap at that price. Without malice aforethought, I had given them the best show that had ever been staged in their territory since the landing of the Pilgrims. It was easily worth $15 million to watch me pull the thing over. It's such a great quote, and it shows his sense of, like, that he just clearly did not care about his victims and was just trying to justify it to himself. Do you get into that kind of stuff? I mean, do you talk about the financial scams, the Ponzi schemes and the pyramid schemes, and that even though kids might not necessarily be coming up against them now, do you bring them up?
In the schools, no. With the adult programs that I do for the company and association events, I do get into that. One of the things I talk about quite a lot is data breach, which sounds terribly dull and boring, but my approach to it is from the human aspect, the human side of things. So instead of getting involved in all the, you know, the IT data breach and hacking and all that, it's simply Joan in accounts, you know, being manipulated to give up her password to someone on the phone and laying them in that way. So I do get into the financial crimes, Ponzi schemes a little bit when I talk to especially groups of retirees. If I'm going to a presentation where there's a lot of older folks there, the Ponzi schemes are constantly being reinvented in different forms as well, so they're never far from the news.
I've noticed that in terms of, say, you know, pyramid schemes, which are obviously slightly different from Ponzi schemes, but in terms of pyramid schemes, there's constantly just minor variations, and they're put back on the market in different ways, designed and also sort of aimed a lot at young people. So there's a lot which I think there's like a free iPhone websites, you know, where the kids can go on, and all they've got to do is sign up four or five friends, and they'll get a free iPhone, so long as the four or five friends also go through this particular process.
Right. Yeah. And the other group that are big target, which is a group that I haven't yet got into speaking with, which are college students. And so young people starting out, being independent for the first time, getting a lot of credit card applications as soon as they, you know, start Freshers Week and get to school, to their colleges. There's a lot of people targeting that particular group. College students are a huge target for all sorts of financial crimes.
Obviously, you've performed these sort of shows for children and adults and old people and so on. Is there ever sort of a sense that you worry that you are yourself going to become overconfident and you're going to be scammed?
Well, I'll tell you this. When I was researching the first book, The Con, I became absolutely paranoid for like a 12-month period because I was just living and breathing this stuff to a degree that I've always had an interest in the topic, but obviously when you're researching a book, you're talking to people, you're talking to victims, you're talking to law enforcement. I was just surrounded by this. And to be honest with you, every time the phone rang or there was a knock at the door, I thought there was someone there to rob me. I mean, I really started getting paranoid about this stuff. And I did, at first, get a little concerned that maybe me being out there as an author on the topic and me giving presentations would make people want to scam me. But I've got to be careful saying this because I'm almost, maybe through your podcast, people are going to like take this as a challenge.
As a challenge,
but to be honest,
yeah.
That's not the way scammers work. I mean, they want to go after the easiest target. And so, they're not interested in making a point. They're interested in making money. So, fortunately, it hasn't come to, but I haven't had denial of service attacks on my website. And I haven't had all these things that I actually really thought was going to happen. And again, having a family, you're concerned about your loved ones, and you don't want anything bad to happen to them either. So I was very concerned about having information about my family online or out there. And I mean, I'm still very careful about all this stuff. But fortunately, no, nothing's really happened or come to pass. Actually, I did have recently a guy email me and try and scam me, and I kind of strung him along for a bit. I don't normally do this, but it was kind of fun. It was one of the guys where they email you about a gig, and then they want to send you some extra money to pay the party planner, and of course then you're going to wire the money to the party planner. And so I immediately knew what his game was, but I thought I'd string him along a bit. And so we went through these really funny exchange, and I had a fake email address that I was using with him. So we went through this whole series of email exchanges, and I was getting more and more ridiculous with him. I was offering him all these crazy clowns, and then apologizing to him because the clown was drunk and had an accident and wouldn't make it. And I was sending him these photos, and I was stringing. And about halfway through, I could tell this guy was getting suspicious of me. He knew that I was messing him about. But there was still the chance there that he was going to get some money out of me. So then it became a game of like how long I was going to be able to string this guy along before he truly got pissed off. And eventually he did. He got very angry. And the final email he sent to me was something about murdering everyone I knew and coming after me. And did give me a little pause. I was like, oh dear, what have I just done? Maybe I shouldn't have wound that guy up too much.
It is amazing. I mean, I get that as well. My website is conman.com.au, and I'm known as the Honest Conman.
Yeah.
And yet I will get emails going saying, dear conman, I'm very interested in your services. And he's like, you not only, not only is this a badly written email in the sense you've called me conman,
right?
You don't even know what the word conman means. I'm very interested in your conman.com.au.
Right.
As you know, it's a scattergun approach, and they're really just trying to see.
But have you ever had any issues with someone you think kind of targeting you because you've got a public profile?
No, not at all. The worst that I've had is more just out, when I've tried to track people in the real world. So, secretly filming people playing the shell game in Barcelona or hunting down people pulling the white van scam and that kind of thing. And kind of they get annoyed in person, but there's never really any sort of far reaching consequences. Cause like you said, they're not making a point. They're making money.
They want to avoid trouble. They don't want to, raise their awareness. They want you to go away. They don't want friends. A good friend is a police officer, and he's for several years, he was in the financial crimes division, and so he would go after gypsy families and he would put them in prison. And I always thought, why they could find out where you live, come after you. And he's like, why would they want to do that? If someone like him is okay, then I'm probably okay too. So I'm almost afraid to say this on a public thing because I don't want to go. So if anyone's out there who thinks it might be a good idea to come after me, please don't.
I like the idea of the of a gang of con artists all crowded around a laptop listening to a podcast and like muttering to each other and banging their fists, and one of them opens the cupboard and they get out their pitchforks and start jump on a plane from Romania to come to Dallas, Texas to have a go at the magician.
Hey, that could be maybe a future novel. I like that. You should do that. You should write that.
That is the next novel. Magician versus con artist. I love it. Fantastic. All right. Just to wrap up, I always like to finish with a game. I call it the Con Artist Dictionary. So I'll give you a word, and then you have to try and figure out what the word means. I try and pick something from your area of expertise, but try and see if I can come up with a word that will stump you. So I think you may already know what this word means.
This is awful. This is a terrible thing to spring on your guests.
I know.
You get them you act all nice to them and have them on your podcast, and then you try and trip them up and embarrass them in front of the millions of people listening. Okay, go on then.
The word is tweaker. So you might know what
tweaker.
It means. A tweaker. Yep. You might know what it means, but you've got to be able to relate it to identity theft.
Okay. I know what this is. A tweaker is the person that's responsible for helping a porn star when they lose their erection in a scene. Is that what that is?
You are so close. That's a fluffer. But that was a wild swing and a miss. But I appreciate the effort behind it.
Oh, I give up. I've no idea what a bloody tweaker is. Tell me.
So a tweaker is basically someone who is on meth. They're a meth addict, and their relation to identity theft is that tweakers have been known to form identity theft rings in order to finance their drug habit. So rather than heroin addicts will break into your house, tweakers will start identity theft rings because one, it's got a really low conviction rate, but the other is when you're tweaking, you can basically concentrate on something for a very long period of time without sleep, and so they'll basically spend hours and hours and hours on meth, falsifying documents and doing research and online and stealing identities.
Well, that's great. I didn't know that term, but I did know that meth addicts are very big into identity theft, and that's a major way they get their money. A big scam that was happening here with the meth addicts in particular was they found some kind of sticky substance. They managed to make some kind of clever device that they would feed into mailboxes or postboxes and be able to pull out people's mail out of them, especially like credit card applications, and go through. So that's what they were doing. And people... the cops couldn't understand it because they kept seeing, these closed circuit videos of cars driving up to mailboxes and then something funny going off and then driving off. And they didn't know what they were doing until they finally caught one of them. And so that's probably got a name as well. Some device they were able to make and manufacture and put down to get people's mail. But it's basically a piece of cardboard, but with a bunch of sticky stuff. So it's like fishing. They fish like a fishing rod. They put into the mailbox to get it out. So
that was a brilliant story. I was not aware of the cardboard fishing. I think that sounds fantastic as well. Brilliant. Thank you so much. Just again, the names of your books are The Con and Cybersense. People can get them online anywhere if they just Google them. But we'll put a link up as well. Just thank you very much for coming on.
This has been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me, and good luck with your books.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.